account, and he's currently at ETH Zurich, and he's going to tell us about.
Yeah, sorry, it's a very long title. Okay, so what I'm going to say today is to talk about hidden variable models that have that go slightly beyond the type of hidden variable models that Bell considered, in that they have both a part that is local and a part that is non-local. And I'll show that at the end of the talk how to relate this to a cryptographic application. And one of the interesting things that comes out of this is that you can even discuss hidden variable models in the case where Alice and Bob's, or the inputs, so to speak, the randomness that you have to use to choose your settings, those can actually depend, or can be partially at least, or in fact almost completely known by the person who's setting up the hidden variables. So another way to say this is that suppose, I mean, if you normally need a concept of sort of free will to decide whether to make your to make the choices of inputs into your devices. And what this will imply that is, even if you don't have very much free will, the outcomes of the devices are still random. So this will become clearer later. Okay, so the general hidden variable model setup, I guess everybody has seen this earlier in the week, but I'll just quickly go through it. So there is some pair of particles created by some kind of, I mean, explosion as I've drawn it here, and particles head out. So these two detectors, each detector has an input. So here the input on this detector is A and this one B, and spits out some output, X and Y. So the whole scenario can be described by this joint probability distribution. So in quantum theory, X and Y are not determined until measured. So there is some wave function. Until the measurement has occurred, you would say that X and Y are not determined. But so the question is, can the correlations be explained by a hidden variable model? Okay, so we introduce some hidden variables. And in this, I'll actually have three hidden variables. So there is U, V, and W. So U is a local hidden variable, and I'll explain what this means in a minute, but it's somehow, we think of it as a hidden variable attached to the particle heading to this detector. And V is also a local hidden variable that's heading to this detector. And there's also W. And W is a non-local hidden variable. And what this, roughly speaking, means is that if you knew W, you could signal. And if you don't know W, you can't signal. So just to say that these hidden variables are, in some sense, the deepest level of hidden variables, in that if you know all of the hidden variables, the outputs here, X and Y, are completely just deterministic functions of all the hidden variables and the settings. But notice that X has to depend on A and B. If you know W, X can depend on A and B. Okay. So let me just relate this to the Bell model, maybe just to help you. So in the Bell model, everything is completely local. So that means that X actually doesn't depend on B, V, or W. It just depends on the local parameters A and U, and similarly Y just on the local parameters B and V. Yeah.
There's no restriction in the Bell inequality on what lambda can be. Or did I misunderstand something?
Well, in the Bell model, there is no W.
Well, but there's this lambda which includes U, W, and V, presumably.
Okay, it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, in that sense, so I would say there is. So in our language, there is no W in the Bell model because there's nothing that allows you to signal. But you can certainly group the hidden variables into one hidden variable. So yeah, I mean, so okay, some people have been confused that I've chosen U and V instead of just one hidden variable lambda. Yeah. So you can just, I mean, the person, suppose there's somebody setting up hidden variables there, of course it's free, there's a possibility that U equals V, and then in the Bell model there'll be just one hidden variable.
Yeah. Actually, I'm confused by this too. I thought that the key point was the measurement that A can depend on the detector setting at B, and like lambda would be U, V, and W normally.
Sorry, maybe we'll see how you're using these.
Yeah, maybe I haven't yet defined what I mean by
a non-local hidden variable model. So maybe this will become clearer in a minute. So I would say in the Bell model, this X can depend just on the local hidden variable. So you can also, I mean, the fact that X is just uniquely dependent on A and the way I've called it U, you can also take U and V to be equal if you like. Okay. So it's obviously the Bell's theorem shows that it's not compatible with quantum theory, but and a completely non-local hidden variable can be compatible with quantum theory. So a completely non-local hidden variable might be one in which, say, there's a preferred frame, and in this preferred frame, this device gave its output first. Well, in a completely non-local hidden variable, that device can just signal very, very quickly to the other device, and that can agree with any quantum correlation or even correlations beyond that. So the question is, what about in-between models? So these are models with both a local and non-local part. And maybe part of the confusion is that I haven't defined that yet. So here's the mixed model. So as before, X is a deterministic function of everything, and similarly Y. Give the model a non-local part. What we say is, if you don't know W, then this probability distribution is equal to this probability distribution. So if you don't know W, X can depend only on A and U and is independent of B and V. So the non-local hidden variable is the variable that if you know it, you can signal. And the local hidden variable model, the local hidden variables are, if you know just the local hidden variables, you can't signal with this distribution.
A sort of space-time diagram can identify which space-time regions the variables refer to. Or would it require still too much time?
So just to get that off. So so you mean that
something like that.
So you so here's A. So the part of the things are created here, and U and V are kind of attached to this branch, and they exist.
Only at that time. They don't depend.
They're just variables that exist all the way through this.
Okay. So that's space time region.
Right.
Okay. And W instead just the point of origin. The hidden variable W refers only at the point of origin.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how to say it in this language.
This is an a-causal system, right?
Yeah, W, so I don't know what to put W.
It's not
I can't put W easily on this diagram.
I mean, if I say just that, if I do disconnect this space-time region, and I say that, like, say, B refers to both, then it's a non-local variable, of course. So I think you can represent it by the space-time diagram in any way, or not?
No, well, the point is they're not. If you know W, they're not actually disconnected.
And in some sense, the correlations that come out some people will say they come from outside space-time. Now, I'm not sure I necessarily like that terminology, but I don't know where to put W on this diagram. Okay, so so this is what we're going to show, is that for models of this type, there can actually be no local part. And what that means is that for a particular set of correlations, this probability distribution here will be uniform and, in particular, independent of U. And that will mean we don't really need U in the model.
And this is what we say means that there is no local part. Okay, so that's what that says. So what that means is that even given access to all the local parameters, the outcomes of the measurement device is going to be completely unpredictable. So roughly speaking, what a local part is that if you did know U, then you could guess X with some probability. So what we know from Bell's theorem is that you can't, for the Bell type correlations, is you can't guess X with certainty. But you could, for the normal CHSH violations, you have some probability of guessing X if you, there is a hidden variable model with local hidden variables where you have some probability of guessing X locally. And what we'll show for a different correlation is that there's no chance of guessing X. So this it will turn out that this distribution must be uniform and independent of U, which means in our language that there's no local part of that hidden variable model. Okay, so let's just briefly explain the correlation. So the correlation is a chained Bell inequality. So I've drawn it. Let me pictorially explain what it is in this diagram. So here's Alice, and this is Alice's choices of measurement. And what these will, I mean, you can for the moment forget this part. So Alice can just choose a bunch of measurements like this, which I'm just going to draw on this diagram like this, and similarly Bob. And what you demand is that what you're going to measure is the following correlation. So you're going to measure the probability that X equals Y. So if A is zero, so this first thing is A and this second thing is B. So this term here is the probability that if Alice measures zero and Bob measures the 2n minus 1 setting, that their outcomes are equal. Okay? Now all the other terms correspond to when Alice and Bob make next door measurements, and then the probabilities must be unequal. Okay, so is it clear what this thing we're measuring is? So the Bell violation is that this is always bigger than, so the Bell inequality says that in a classical or a completely local theory, this is always bigger than or equal to one. So let me briefly try to convince you of that. So let's suppose we want to make this as small as possible classically. Well, classically, what we have to do is basically assign an output to each possible input here. So let's suppose we arbitrarily, let's just pick this to have output zero. Okay, well, in order to make this term corresponding to this line here as small as possible, we better make this zero as well, because there's a term in here which is the probability that X does not equal to Y given A is zero and B is one. So we want to make this thing equal. So if that's zero, that had better be zero. Okay, to try and make, so then all these terms are going to be zero, because then I should make that zero, that zero, that zero. But when I get all the way to the bottom, there's this kind of frustration in the system because of this line here, I've had to make this zero. But if I do that, then these two are equal, but I actually want the probability that they're, so then the probability they're equal is one. Okay, so that's, I mean, that's not a proof, but that's a brief argument as to why the Bell inequality is that this should be bigger than or equal to one. Okay, so now let me explain why quantum mechanically you can make this actually zero or arbitrarily close to it. So here are the quantum mechanical settings. So these correspond to directions in the Bloch sphere with an angle like this. And basically what this corresponds to is if I pick the A is zero and the B is one, these angles are virtually identical. In the limit of large n, they're virtually identical. And if they're virtually identical, if I put in an EPR pair, then I can make sure that the probability that these are equal is, I mean, then these are always equal. So the probability that they're non-equal is zero. Okay, so I can keep going down and these are virtually zero. But at the end, I'm measuring in the opposite direction, roughly. So these are essentially, so then I've got a Bell pair and I'm measuring the things in the opposite direction, so the outcomes are not equal. So not only are these terms all zero, this term is also all zero. Okay, so that's the correlation that we're going to use. Okay, so here's the theorem. So I'm not going to present the proof, but so this is, I call this the original version of the theorem because I'll show a slightly stronger version a bit later. So the theorem is that for any non-signaling distribution, and if A and B are can be chosen independently of the hidden variables, then for all A and B, we have this. So what this means is the following. So this is the probability distribution of X and U given A. So this is the this is the outcome on Alice's side. This is the hidden Alice's local hidden variable given Alice's measurement setting. Okay, and for the moment, I'll explain what D means in a minute, but it's basically a distance between probability distributions. So we show that this and this one here is the probability of X bar, which is the uniform distribution on X, multiplied by PU, which is just the distribution over the hidden variables. Okay, so if this D is small, that means that these two distributions are roughly equal. Okay, and as I have argued, so the theorem says that this thing should be smaller than or equal to IN over 2. This is just a theorem about non-signaling probability distribution. Okay, and the fact is that quantum mechanics allows me to, in the limit of large N, so as I increase the number of measurement settings, I can get IN to 10 to 0. And that shows that in that limit, this distance is zero, which means that X, basically the distribution over X, is uniform and independent of the hidden variable. Okay. So, okay, I've been to brief just the significance why we've chosen D. So, I mean, D is just a measure of the distance between distributions. It's directly determines the maximum probability of correctly guessing the two distributions. So if I have two distributions, I want to guess between them. The probability of guessing correctly between them is given by this. So if D is zero, what that basically means is that there's no chance of guessing between them. The probability of guessing between them is half. You might as well not look at what came out. And this basically means that these distributions behave identically in all situations. Okay, so, right, so here's actually how IN goes as a function of N. I guess I've already said this. So it tends to zero, hence this distance can be bounded by an arbitrarily small number. Okay, and in the limit, it's exactly equal, and hence there is no local part in the hidden variable model. Okay. Okay, so I've got about 5 minutes left. But all.
Had 10 minutes in the talk and then another 5 minutes.
Okay, okay, good. So now what I'm going to do is discuss this in a cryptographic setting. So let's consider trying to use these correlations to establish a shared random key. So instead of having this explosion here that's creating particles that are heading out, what we're going to do, so we're going to replace this with an eavesdropper here. So this is a kind of Eckert type cryptography scenario, and this eavesdropper potentially holds on to a system of her own and sends out parts to Alice and Bob. Okay, now, so the type of security that we're going to consider is we're going to let Eve basically eavesdropper, the middle person, create this whole distribution and demand security even so. And if Alice and Bob, so in this scenario, basically instead of the local hidden variables, I now have this parameters, potentially C and Z. Okay, and if this this C and Z, I can actually run the same theorem, replacing the local hidden variables by C and Z. And if Alice and Bob can measure, and they measure this IN quantity, if it's small, they're guaranteed that their output strings X and Y were uniform and independent of the hidden variable. So that connects it to a cryptographic scenario. And actually, this is essentially the idea used by Barrett, Hardy, and Kent for the as a security of quantum key distribution against non-signaling eavesdroppers. Okay, so now, yes.
So in the middle there,
It's another measuring device. Sorry, this arrow means that these things came. Maybe this arrow should really come from up here. So the eavesdropper creates three systems, one of which she keeps, which is this system. Potentially, she might not need to do that, but she may do that. And the other two systems she gives to Alice and Bob. No, Eve created that and sent it to Alice and Bob.
Okay.
That's in the box. Or that's right. Right.
Okay. So what you're showing is she doesn't have to be where an adversary page prior set up the checking point. This is something that you check what exists.
Right. So if they check these correlations and they can if they can verify that IN is small, then they'll be assured of the security. Right. 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 So the eavesdropper is only constrained to be non-signal. Right, exactly. Okay. So now what I'm going to show is a stronger version of the theorem. So actually, remarkably, it turns out that if, so it's kind of, in the original form of the theorem, we have that A was, let me just go back. So the theorem is that for any non-signaling distribution, and for A and B independent of the hidden variables, so that A and B, I mean, we just assume that, that Alice and Bob are completely free to choose the A and B as they like. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the eavesdropper some information about A. Okay, so now what I can do is prove a new theorem. So here's the original theorem. So we managed to bound this distance here. Okay, now in the new version of the theorem, what we're going to bound is this distance here. And let me just explain the difference. So this is the distance of the distribution of X, Z, and C given A and B. And what we're allowing is we're allowing Z and C. So notice that Z and C depend on A and B. So we're allowing the eavesdropper to choose her input. So her input is C. And we're in particular, that can depend on A and B. Okay, and what we can show is that this probability distribution is also very close to this distribution. So this is a uniform distribution on X multiplied by just the part on the eavesdropper system. So if you can measure IN, and if you can verify that IN is small, you actually can show that even if Z and C were chosen depending on A and B, the output X is uniform. And random, or arbitrarily close to uniform. And in a cryptographic setting, what this means is that if Alice and Bob have strings of low privacy, they can enhance that privacy. So the low privacy, what that means is that, I mean, this A is the initial random string they're going to input into this box. It having low privacy means that, I mean, it has low privacy because we allow the eavesdropper in the middle to virtually know it with certainty. But even if the eavesdropper knows it with virtual certainty, this output string X is uniform and independent. I mean, it's in a product distribution with everything on the eavesdropper side. And I think this is quite a remarkable property of these correlations. So the only thing we have to assume, so we also allow signaling. I mean, to prove this theorem, we allow signaling between this system and this system. The only non-signaling thing we don't allow is that X cannot depend on B and Y cannot depend on A. But it's kind of natural to allow signaling from the middle system, because this could have, I mean, the eavesdropper creates this, right? So she can certainly set her systems to output X accordingly. Okay, so that's the main message, or that's the main, I would say the main very interesting result. Okay, so I'll just sum up. So what I have explained is that in order to explain quantum correlations with a hidden variable model, such a hidden variable model cannot have any local part. So the only types of hidden variable model that agree with this type of quantum correlation is a completely non-local hidden variable. The local part is related to the knowledge an eavesdropper could have on the output string. So correlations with no local part are completely private. Okay, and the stronger version of the theorem shows that these correlations can be used to enhance the privacy. So even if you have a very highly well-known initial string, the output string from the device is still private and is private and random. So, okay, thank you.
Okay, so are you assuming quantum mechanics?
You already the theorem doesn't assume quantum mechanics. The only point you put quantum mechanics in is to measure this, to show that there is, the quantum correlations allow this IN value to be arbitrarily small. But the theorem is just a theorem about joint probability distributions with non-signal constraint.
Okay, because I'm trying to figure out if the whole thing can be done without reference to hidden variables. Or, because if it's just quantum mechanics, it should be able to be done without reference to hidden variables. But if you're going beyond that, you're saying even if quantum mechanics is wrong, but we still have something.
Right, it applies beyond quantum mechanics to any kind of non-signaling theory.
Okay. So the only restriction is that the theory, whether it be quantum mechanics or something else, has to satisfy this no local part idea.
If within whatever theory it is, you have correlations, which you can show that IN is zero. There exist correlations this type of correlation with IN is zero, then the theorem holds. So as long as those type of correlations exist, it will be.
Okay, cool. Do we know of anything that's, sorry to follow up with it, but I mean, would say these non-local boxes of Popescu fall into this? Are there other things that fall into this?
Yeah, I mean, so these correlations exist in quantum theory, so presumably they exist also in theories that allow more non-locality than quantum theory.
Why would that be? As long as there are no signals?
As long as there are no signals.
Okay.
I mean, usually when you go beyond quantum theory, you introduce stronger correlation, I would say. So a non-local box is a stronger type of correlation.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe you don't. If you go to beyond quantum theory in a way that doesn't allow some, in a way that allows weaker, has weaker correlations, then somehow there's a restriction that the correlations are weak, then maybe. I haven't really thought about this that hard.
All right.
Okay.
So this IN value in the quantum case is like 1 over N? So
it goes like 1 over N, right?
So, but do you have any idea if it could be made exponentially small? N is the number of
choices of. And it's the number of choices of measurement sets.
Sorry, it's the dimension of the local, the entangled state that you have.
The entangled state, no, the entangled state, you just need a qubit.
Oh, you just need a qubit.
Right, it's only the number of measurement settings.
Oh, okay. But yeah, so you have made it exponentially small, or probably that can't be done?
Exponentially small in the number of devices. I mean, I have no idea right now how to, whether that could be done. I haven't thought about that actually. I mean, it's very experimentally challenging to measure these correlations.
Okay.
half a question.
So now it's my turn for your turn for another mean-spirited philosophical question. How did you sense that? It's good.
You had it before.
Oh, I didn't. So in part of your talk, I riffed a bit and I started thinking about what might have happened soon after the straight edge and the compass were invented. People started using them to make regular polygons. So they made three-sided polygons with ruler and compass, and four-sided and five-sided. Six-sided, eight-sided, a whole load of them. It was an industry, and it looked like it was a general rule of nature that one could use a ruler and a compass to make any regular polygon that they wanted. But it seems that a seven-sided polygon was a holdout, and people tried and tried and tried to figure out a way of doing this. Can you see where this is going? they tried and tried. To make it with a straight edge and a compass, and they couldn't. And then this guy from Japan came up who knew origami, and he pointed out that if you forget about the ruler and the compass, but instead use paper, you can fold paper in just the right way to get a regular seven-sided polygon. And then sometime after that, Galois came up and formalized the idea, and he proved that, in fact, you can't construct a seven-sided regular polygon with ruler and compass. Well, the guy from Japan said, I can do it with my paper folding technique. But it seems that there was now we get fantastical. So just imagine that there's a community of people who really insisted on doing it with a ruler and compass. And so they started exploring the idea of not exactly a compass, but maybe a compass with a little spring of a certain spring constant in between. Could they do it with that? And they set off to prove theorems. They showed that it violated the conditions of Galois' theorem. But nonetheless, they couldn't use that kind of device to get the seven-sided polygon. And then somebody comes along and says, well, what happens if we put the spring constant on one of the arms? Can we then get the construction with the ruler and compass? And they couldn't. As you can imagine, this kind of became a dull game to play after a while. People forgot about it, and except the Galois theory, and started moving on with Galois. So my question to you is, when does one get bored with questions of hidden variables and decide that maybe there's just something radical going on, and that one should drop the idea of ruler and compass and just
right now,
play it all again.
After our theory, you should decide.
So can we start to consider, still subtler variations where we don't have a non-local part and a local part, but we have a non-local part, a local part, and
they can't have any local part. So I guess the take-home message is if you like coming up with hidden variable models, don't stick a local part. I don't know if you like coming up with hidden variable models. If you're not interested in hidden variable models, then maybe it's...
Okay, so that'll be refine the question, but make it shorter and
more
serious. Yeah, once this has been proven, okay, so you it's a negative result. How does one use this as a method for moving on to actually what should be a positive result ultimately? And I don't know what that would be, but exactly, which paths do these no-go theorems, where do they really take you?
Right.
I told you to be philosophical.
I'm not sure how to answer this. So what do you want from a hidden variable? Or what you, I guess, want is some kind of, you're kind of clinging to some kind of notion of classicality. And if you want to cling to that notion of classicality, then you can't, not only can it not be local, but it must allow signaling, but it can't even have some form of locality. It must be, in a sense, completely non-signaling. So all of the types of hidden variable models where you have really, if you really want your outcomes to have some notion of classicality,
then they might as well just be one. They might as well just have a. I mean, you don't maybe don't have to think exactly like this, but they might as well be of the type where there's a frame, preferred frame, and then instantaneous signal.
So the way you put it is, if you want to cling to classicality, then you get such a result.
Right.
I think he's trying to put the realist in a smaller box.
So once you've got into the small box, I mean, does this give any guidance for breaking out the box? I guess it doesn't. I just want to hear your version of it.
I mean, I guess it depends what you want from a variable model. Or what do you look for in a hidden variable model that makes you, and why do you want to believe in a hidden variable model?
But Roger, you can still uphold the local part if your settings are determined by the hidden variables.
If
your settings are determined by the hidden variables.
Right, if you're really, really paranoid,
or
then,
some other mechanism, retrocausality, I don't care.
So if you really don't believe in any free will at all, then
you can have local parts too.
Right.
But that's the price you have to pay. Okay. You have to pay a price.
Can I ask a strongly non-philosophical question? you go back a few slides. You're talking about how you allow for signaling between C and the outcomes that cause the result to end. So you said that, for example, X could depend on C.
Right.
But what's confusing me is that you said that the eavesdropper could know about the setting of B. So C could have a lot of information about B.
Right.
So how is it that X can depend on C and yet be totally independent of B?
It's a formal mathematical constraint that it's just that the probability of X and the probability of X is independent of B. But it can only depend on B through C. Maybe that's
seems like a screening off condition. Screens off B.
Right.
So you know as much about B as you could.
Well,
yeah.
Do you have an accurate example?
A concrete example of what?
A distribution like this that has some non-trivial dependence on C, but.
I don't want to try and come up with one right now, but I'm sure it would take. I could discuss this or come up with one.
So can you maybe just tell me what's wrong with my line of reasoning? So my line of reasoning says C knows almost everything about B. So there's very little ambiguity, very little freedom in choice of setting. And X is going to know as much because C can signal to X. So yet, you know, there's no signaling from B to X because.
So when I condition, I have this distribution probability of X given B and C.
Yes.
Okay, now what do? I condition out. So if I take the marginal distribution, so there's a joint distribution probability of X, B, and C. Now if I take the marginal distribution on
Is it just that conditioning X on C and B is the same thing as conditioning X on C?
If I condition on B and C, it's the same as conditioning on
screen
C. Yes. Thank you.
That's true, but it's not sufficient. Because if C is equal to B always, then X conditioned on C and B is equal to X conditioned on C, but it's also equal to X conditioned on B.
Right.
So it is a stronger condition than that.
So the type of
that's necessary, I think.
I mean, what do I mean? I mean that the distribution of X given, say, B and C, that's equal to the probability of X given C.
Right.
That's the only thing you need.
No, I don't think so.
That's all you need.
That's all you need to prove the theorem.
Oh, okay, maybe. But
But it's not. Right. That's not enough to ensure that X is independent of B.
Given C.
Okay. Sorry.
X
maybe
is
this is the confusion. But this is
X is independent. The condition that he wants is that X is independent of B without C present.
That doesn't hold.
And that doesn't follow.
Is that what you want? Do you want X to be independent of B?
No, the only thing I need is
you only
this.
Care about that.
Yes.
So that's necessary for saying this is a non-signaling dispute in between Alice and Bob. Okay. So maybe it's not necessary for the theorem.
Right.
It's not necessary for the set.
Yes, but that doesn't. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, but for things that are non-signaling, then it's even a stronger thing. So maybe I said it was non-signaling between X and B, but what I didn't really mean that is I actually meant really this. Maybe that's what caused the confusion. So yeah, I think it was I used the wrong terminology.
All right, any short questions? No? Okay, let's think. Okay.